You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, broadcasting at 99.3 FM and streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with author and Zen monk Shozan Jack Haubner, whose new book is Single White Monk. Before I transition to our first interview, I'll share a little information about our guest host this week, Kim McQueen. You may recognize Kim's name because she's been on the show before. Kim McQueen serves as a faculty advisor to Champlain College students in the Professional Writing, Creative Media, Communications, and Film programs. And she's managing editor for the Champlain College Center for Publishing, which produces Weather Vane and other print and digital publishing projects. She also serves as an adjunct instructor in the professional writing program. Kim has 25 years of experience in writing and editing for a variety of general interest and academic publications. She's the author of two novels, Out Out, a novel of women and apes, and People Who Hate America, which was published by Champlain Books. She's currently a student at Bay Path University's MFA program in creative nonfiction. I interviewed Kim about People Who Hate America in 2015. You can find that conversation on the podcast site. At this point, I'll turn it over to Kim McQueen and her conversation with Shozan Jack Haubner.
Shozan Jack Haubner is the author of the book Single White Monk, Tales of Death, Failure, and Bad Sex, although not necessarily in that order. His essays have appeared in The Sun, Tricycle, Buddha Dharma, and The New York Times, as well as the Best Buddhist Writing Series. The winner of a 2012 Pushcart Prize, he's also the author of Zen Confidential, Confessions of a Wayward Monk. Here's the publisher's book jacket summary of Single White Monk. Think the life of a Zen monk is all serenity, peace, and austerity? Think again. Here, Shozan Jack Haubner gives us an often hilarious, always candid account of what it's really like behind those monastery walls. Haubner's adventures include memories of his dysfunctional Midwestern family that drove him ultimately to declare, "I think I should be a monk," to a madcap account of the night he got stoned and snuck out of the monastery, alongside more sobering accounts, such as his life-threatening brush with illness, the profound impact of a dear friend's death, and reflections on the controversy that rocked his Zen community. That he finds timeless wisdom in both the tragic and the absurd is a tribute to Haubner's gifts as a writer and humorist, and to his clear insights into the nature of self and what the practice of Zen is all about. I spoke to Shozan Jack Haubner in October. We began our conversation by talking about his first book, Zen Confidential, which concerns his journey from life as an ex-Catholic screenwriter to that of a Zen monk. I hope you enjoy listening.
I wanted to ask you first about your first book, Zen Confidential, which is about really about your life leading up to becoming a monk. And it captures your first few years at the Mount Baldy Zen Center in California. So I'd like to start out by talking about that book first. I wondered if you could give us a snapshot of why and how you went to work on that first book, and maybe even any main intent you might have had for it.
Yeah, I mean, how I wound up, actually, I had been working in Hollywood on screenplays, reading them, thousands of them, from the slush pile of various producers and agents, and working on my own screenplays myself. And I ultimately realized I had absolutely nothing to say whatsoever. And that coincided with meeting a really neat Zen Buddhist monk in Los Angeles who eventually became my friend and mentor, and yada, 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 I wound up at a Zen Buddhist monastery, Mount Baldy Zen Center. And I stopped writing. I just kind of let it go. And then, you know, I could ask you as well, and any writer, what is our intention when we write? I mean, it's sort of like the you just have something to say and it starts coming out. Yeah. It was a really unique life up there. It was kind of interesting. I mean, the thing that precipitated it was we had these, I might have talked to you about this, but we have these compost toilets. So the idea was that you would do your business in a compost toilet, and then you would mix in a large amount of wood chips with the collective business of camp. And eventually, this would sort of, through the miracle of nature, transform into rich living, fecund earth. But that wasn't exactly how it worked. So I had to put on this hazmat suit and go in there with a shovel and kind of mix the wood chips in with this enormous quantity of raw human waste. As I was doing that, it just hit me of what a metaphor this was for the practice that I was trying to do. We did Rinzai Zen Buddhism, which was Samurai Zen, very straightforward, strict, disciplined Zen Buddhism. And that was like the sort of the carbon or the wood chips. And then you got this steaming, overwhelming, crappy inner life, right? And you mix the two together and hope you can get some rich, fertile, living ground. And that kind of kicked the whole book off. I think in one way or another, each essay is in that vein of mixing this classic, traditional, straightforward practice with messy human beings and seeing what arises.
Yeah. Yeah. You had mentioned before, too, that when you originally went up to Mount Baldy, that you, like you said, you'd stopped writing. And I wonder if you could talk about how you got back into it. How long did that process take before you realized you're writing a book?
I don't know that I ever realized I was writing a book until I held it in my hands, to be honest with you. I mean, anything can go wrong. That's why I wrote essays, just so, you know, one piece at a time. You know, it took me about a year before I was just sort of fully writing again. I didn't plan on writing when I was at the monastery. Like I said, it's a very full schedule and it holds your attention. And that's the point. You take your inner life and you give it to your circumstances, which is this tight, clear, clean schedule. Yeah. And there's not a lot of room in there. But somehow the exterior circumstances of the practice also got in and started stirring things up. And so I moved to the monastery, I think it was in April. And then I got a Christmas gift from my mom, which was this really beautiful journal. And I kind of just started taking down notes and thoughts, and one led to another, and that was at Christmas. So, and then about a year later, the following April, from when I'd moved there, I got the idea to put something down about the compost toilets, and then from there, it just sort of grew.
Well, since we're talking about this, let's take a second and talk about your actual path to publication, which, you know, a lot of fellow writers and listeners are, you know, always interested in that. How did you go from writing about the compost toilets to holding a book in your hand?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, because that's exactly what I would have wanted to know before I published the book. You know, when I was working on, it was interesting. So that first piece, working on the compost toilets, it's about, I think, it can't be more than 2,000 words. And it took me a long time. So it became almost kind of a mantra. I mean, I'm not, as a monk, I'm not too proud to admit this. As a writer, I can't help but admit it. I would be sitting on the cushion meditating, and this idea would come back to me. And it got to the point where I had the whole thing memorized, and not on purpose, but just I was working on it so much. Each word I was working on, and I'd be sitting on the cushion, and some new part of it would come to me, and I would sort of slightly change a phrase. But I was only halfway through, and I couldn't get past that halfway point. So I threw something down, and I gave it to my mentor who reads all my stuff, and he didn't like it, and I gave it to somebody else, and she didn't like it. And, you know, I had imagined, this is back when there was something called print publication, and there was a magazine called The Whole Life Times, which probably doesn't exist anymore. But I thought, you know what, maybe this will be like a little personal essay that they have in the back of The Whole Life Times. And I had really modest aspirations. So in terms of helpful hints for writers looking for publication, I mean, sort of consciously and sort of unconsciously, my process was to not aim super high. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just wanted to get something down and have it not suck, right? And have a small number of people not think it sucks as well. And so I picked a genre, and the genre was, it's what I call the here's what I learned at camp essay. You know, it's basically like when a kid comes back from summer vacation, the teacher asks him to write something about what he did that summer. He writes, here's what I learned at camp. And that was basically what it was, a personal essay in the Buddhist literature genre, mixing in humor. And so I read everything I could on that topic. We had a library at the monastery with all the old Tricycle and Shambhala Sun magazines. And I read every single personal essay in those magazines and got a feel for the genre. And I tried to write this piece past the halfway point. I mean, it's a point when you get stuck as an unpublished writer that you just can't get past. When I was in Hollywood, they said, you know, every writer has an Academy Award winning first draft of one act sitting in a drawer somewhere. You know, it's hard to get past a certain point. At one point, I think I just kind of powered through it. I remember saying consciously, okay, I know what I need to do here. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to intuit my way through this anymore and keep trying to pin the tail on the donkey. I'm going to figure out what I need to do and just do it. And that's kind of what I did. And then I remember giving it to my mentor. I had a few days off, and we were at the Grove, which is a big, massive shopping complex in Los Angeles. We were sitting there drinking coffee, and I remember giving it to him, and he said, look, he said, if they don't publish this at Tricycle, it just means whoever rejected it is having a bad day there. And that was when I knew, okay, I got something done here. But
So he didn't like your first draft, but your second draft, you powered through.
Well, it was the first draft that he saw. There were many, many, many drafts in there. Yeah, something shifted on the second draft. So, for unpublished writers, it's like something can shift. You may be holding what is, by everybody's estimation, a piece of garbage in your hands, but don't give up, because it can that shit can turn into gold, so to speak.
So was that your first publication, was Tricycle?
I mean, it was kind of, I published some stuff in some newspapers in Los Angeles, some few like comical essays and some reviews of plays and movies and stuff, but I think for the most part that was my first publication.
So you're beginning life as a monk up on the mountain, and you're stealing away to write whenever you can. Mm-hmm. What was the reaction on the part of your community when you first started?
You know, I lost a lot of sleep because I'd be up at night jotting this stuff down. I spent my days off jotting it down. So I don't know if it was that noticeable, but when I started publishing it was interesting. It was kind of one of those sort of open secrets, I guess. I mean, generally speaking, in the Buddhist community, Zen Buddhist community, or at least the community that I was in, there was kind of a zeitgeist of if you can show up and do the practice, people kind of leave you alone and mind their own business. They tend to be very tolerant that way. But, you know, when I started publishing, I think some people liked it, some people didn't, which I can completely understand. I internalized all of the static that was out there about my writing. So, I mean, there was a feeling sometimes of, okay, you know, you kind of need to choose. You either be a part of this community or you write, but you can't do both, especially if you're going to write about me, was kind of a feeling.
But you existed as a writer and a monk for years.
Yeah, for a long time. Like, actually about 12 years,
So And you start talking in the second book, Single White Monk, which I've just finished and absolutely loved. But you talk a little bit about this reaction to your writing on behalf of the members of your community in LA. And it was really interesting to read how people interpreted when you wrote about the Roshi. Right.
Yeah.
So I want to sort of get into that a little bit. And because I want to understand, did you get the feeling that it was not okay to write about him at all? Can we talk about the reaction on the part of your community when you wrote about the Roshi?
Yeah. Boy, that's a complex question. I mean, it's almost like we have to take each word and dissect it.
Yeah.
It depends what you mean by reaction.
Yeah.
It also depends what you mean by community, because there were so many different people in that community with different viewpoints, oftentimes at the same time. I chose to write about a difficult time in our community, and then I chose to publish it. And I think I crossed a line in some people's eyes by doing that. So, I struggled with it, and I still struggle with it.
So let's talk a little bit about that. Are you talking about the scandal in the community that you deal with at the end of the second book?
Yeah.
And really the second book takes the reader through the whole process as you move through and then out of that community. So my first question as a reader was, did you know how this book was going to end with your leaving?
No. I had no idea how it would end. I mean, as I was working on the after, I mean, I finished the book, turned it in for publication, was completely done with it. Without having to go into too many particulars about the actual history of why I left, which involves people who just made it very clear they didn't want to be talked about publicly, much less in my book. So without making that clear, or without having to sort of unpack all of that,
mm-hmm.
It got around that I had written this book, and then I had this essay about the scandal. And, you know, I got a lot of support from some people that it mattered that I got their support. But there were some people that just didn't like the idea that I had written about my teacher.
Mm-hmm.
There was kind of a feeling with some people of, this is crossing a line. You don't, as a monk, you know, at your teacher's head temple, even though he's dead, mm-hmm. and even though the scandal is out there and it's, you know, public domain for the most part, it's not appropriate. And it's not, at the very least, it's not an expression of gratitude for what your teacher did do to you to speak openly about these things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's that. And that was a strong, you know, some people felt that very strongly, you know. And I'd written about some people specifically in the piece, although very, very disguised in the essay. And that was not kosher with them. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, you're right. I got away with writing about this stuff for years and years and years and pushed the line a little bit more on each essay on some level
mm-hmm.
in terms of what it's sort of appropriate to talk about, I think.
Well, and you also really dealt with it in this scandal. The essay about the scandal is also kind of an essay about death itself, right? Which
right.
is a huge Buddhist topic. And you talk about the whole turmoil in the community almost as it mirrored the illness of your teacher.
Right.
So that must have taken a long time just to figure out how you were going to write about this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that piece, which I don't know, it's maybe 15,000 words. So it's a long essay, but it took me a full year of solid writing. I mean, I had like several hundred thousand words that I had to winnow down. I had to compact the different angles of this Rashomon-like story. So yeah, it took me. Yeah, it was a labor of love. Let's put it that way.
I feel like it really captures. One thing that I feel like you really captured well was this feeling of sort of suspended animation when you're reacting to all these comments. You're asked to write a letter, right, of apology for this. And without going into too much detail, I did want to say how much I really loved how just incredibly tense and uncomfortable it comes across that you were during this time. And then, you know...
I lost my... Is that what you're trying to say?
No. As a reader, I was doing the same kind of thing, I think, is what I was trying to get across.
Right.
I want to say how much as a reader that was so excruciating to read about what you were going through as you, you know, we were asked to apologize, and then you apologize, and then people sort of start jumping on you constantly. I guess I want to hear you talk a little bit more about losing it, about how that affected your writing process.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, you know, there were a few things I mean, like I said, it's such a huge topic, and it's such a delicate topic. So the first thing I guess I was cognizant of doing was just kind of writing about my own experience around the scandal. I mean, we had so many moderated meetings within our community. So many different points of view were voiced, and so many different positions were sort of argued and cried over and aired. And at one point I thought, you know, I kind of just want to tell my own story around this. Mm-hmm. And it certainly, like you said, and as you picked up on, it was definitely not a story about a scandal necessarily. I mean, the scandal was within this bigger context, and the second half of the book where that essay about the scandal is called The Four Deaths of My Teacher, and that's really what I wanted to concentrate on.
Right.
And this is hard to, I've never been able to put this into words, even in that whole essay, but you know, something interesting happened during those final few years of my teacher's life. I mean, the first thing that happened, the first death, was when he got really, really sick with aspiration pneumonia.
Right.
And it was touch and go. Myself and his attendant were with him at the hospital as this 100-plus-year-old man really just went into the underworld. I mean, he was physically and mentally obliterated by this aspiration pneumonia and almost died. Somehow he came back from that and reached sort of a new but, I guess, more contracted plateau. And there he stayed for a while, and he was no longer our teacher.
Yeah,
I mean, our teacher died. He never formally taught again after he got sick. So that was like the first death. Suddenly, the guy was still there, but he was no longer a teacher, and he didn't talk about this at all. I mean, I was the head monk at the monastery, and I had a training season going. And I finally, when he was sort of able to interact again, I asked him, okay, what are we going to do? I've got, you know, a dozen students up on the mountain for 3 months. Mm-hmm. They're here because of you. They want to do koan practice and retreats with you. And he said, basically, I can't take responsibility for these students anymore. And that was it. So the teacher died. Then several months later, the article appeared online that was the broke the dam for the scandal, which flushed out. And in that moment, his name died, his you know, public reputation died. And something I would argue kind of died within our community. And then after that, he didn't name a successor. And in the Zen Buddhist tradition, that's everything on some level. Without him naming a successor, we can't continue the practice the way we had done it with him, because there's no one acknowledged as a Zen master, so no one can teach at a certain level. No one can offer koan practice, which is a huge chunk of Rinzai Zen Buddhism. So the lineage essentially died. His spiritual lineage was not passed on. That died, and then finally, a year or two later, his physical body died. He died. And what I wanted to sort of capture through, I guess, this is the wrong word, but through the drama of the scandal, I wanted to capture that experience of complete death, like leaving no trace. I mean, this guy did not leave a trace when he left us. There was nothing to grab onto, to stand on, no religion for us to sort of carry on in his absence. And that's what I wanted to capture. I mean, there's something. I didn't want it to be depressing, although I started reading some of the Amazon reviews, and I don't think I succeeded in that aim. But I thought it was real. It's like, this is what happens sometimes. Like, you can't use you can't come up with, you can't softball death, you know?
Yeah.
Even though we try with our religions, we want everything to be okay. We want to come up with a truism or a cliche to gloss over the idea of death, but it's real. And that, in some sense, is one of his legacies that he left to me, is just that experience, which is totally profound, and I'm still grappling with it.
You're listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. An interview with author and Zen monk Shozan Jack Haubner. If you're enjoying this show, please consider liking it on Facebook, rating it in iTunes, or tweeting about Write the Book. Thanks, and stay tuned for the rest of the interview.
So, you know, you write early in Single White Monk, which is really funny in a lot of places. And also really deep. So I think you pulled off... it's not totally sad.
Good.
but, you know, I was struck by one mention that you make early on that led me to think that you weren't really having a super good time, even as a monk, even when things were going, you know, before things started to go south, right? Did you like being a monk?
I loved being a monk. I like challenges. You know, when I was writing, I hated it too. Don't get me wrong. Oh, God. I mean, it was beautiful. It was, you know, it's hard to find a meaningful responsibility in this world.
Yeah.
And I had it at the monastery. I loved it, but it's a hard, hard life, especially when you've got a Zen master driving that life that... is old school. I mean, it's like you opened a classic koan collection and out jumped this ancient Japanese Zen master hitting you with a stick for 13 years, you know? It's real. I mean, it was hard, very hard. Part of my processing the difficulties and challenges was writing about them. But I did love it. But man, every second of it was, it had me... right on the edge of my wits, sanity, patience level.
Did you ever sort of crave a little bit less difficult of a practice?
Well, that's a good, crave is a good word. I mean, you know, I wonder now that I'm out of it. No, I didn't necessarily crave a less difficult practice, but that raises the question of, do you get addicted to the difficulty? Does it become...
Oh, yeah.
Does it become, it's so hard. Are you able to actually hide from yourself because you think you're accomplishing something just by getting through a retreat because it's so difficult, you know, or getting through a training season? People, a certain kind of personality that likes challenges, and is suffering deeply may be able to, almost numb themselves through extreme spiritual practice. So, you know, that question comes up for me.
Did it change the nature of what you wrote?
The difficulty?
The process of becoming a monk and living that life changed that?
Yeah, I think it in some ways kind of gave me confidence. It gave me almost like a platform to stand on and say, okay, this is what I've done. It's unique.
So what if I was to say, you get to go back to Hollywood and be a screenwriter again? Could you?
I'd say, please, no.
So for all its difficulty, it does seem like it was just such a better, firmer place than you were when you started.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God, yeah. I needed that difficulty, I think. I'll tell you a story. It was interesting. I mean, you know, that classic cliche about you leave home, make this long journey only to wind up at home again.
Yeah.
I remember when I first went to the monastery, right before I went, I was living in Fountain Avenue in West Hollywood, and I had this neighbor who was this strange, brilliant, half Jewish, half Jamaican Talmud scholar who smoked a lot of pot. Okay. So before I went to the monastery, I partook in the a few of these things with him. And in a haze of smoke, we were discussing my future. And he said, okay, what do you want? What do you want? And I said, well, I want to go to the monastery and I want to, you know, I had all these esoteric answers about learning truth and going deeper into Zen Buddhism and Zen practice. And over and over, he just brushed that aside and he said, what do you want? Cut to about 5, 6, 7 years later, we come to the end of a really long retreat and a very busy day. And I come back to my cabin and I remember picking up a book that I had laying around and holding it. And thinking, and actually saying, just holding the, I was so tired. I was so exhausted, but not, I mean, in a good way, in a spent way. And I remember holding this book and thinking, oh, I want one of these. And it was almost like that constant, grueling, difficult work cleaned me out and made me get real. I remember holding that book, just holding the weight of the book, all those words in that book had actual weight in my hand, and just thinking, I want one of these, you know?
Wow.
It was interesting.
That's fantastic. Let's talk about death a little more.
Please.
So one of my favorite pieces in the book, you write about being sick really well. It's really interesting and it's always funny. There's this there's a moment in this essay where you are sure that you have just been told that you are terminal. And it really kind of, for me as a reader, really sort of sums up what I like about your writing, because you were, can we talk a minute about that scene?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it sounded like you were elated to be told that you were terminal.
Well, yeah, it's funny because, you know, I initially published that chapter in Tricycle Magazine, and I put it down almost literally word for word what happened in that moment. And the editors got back to me, and all of my other, you know, white lies and minor fabrications in that essay were believable. But that moment, which I captured in its truthful entirety, they were like, this doesn't read like this happened. But it happened exactly that way. I mean, what happened was I was at the monastery alone by myself, and I started profusely vomiting. And it was coming out of both ends, let's put it that way, for a long period of time. So I finally called 911, and they took me to the hospital and started running me past these, you know, giving me these tests and blood and this, that, and the other thing. At one point, I was in the ER, and at one point, this nurse came in. She's kind of talking to me, and she said, well, you've got these really elevated enzyme levels. In a situation like this, looking at your charts, I would say you have pancreatic cancer. She said, okay, you know, Pavarotti just died from that. It's fairly lethal. And she was like kind of, you know, she was like talking about what she'd seen on TV last night. Now, the interesting thing about this moment was, first of all, there was like this feeling of relief because I finally knew what the problem was. I mean, it's amazing how much anxiety you can have over an undefined problem.
Yeah.
Which to jump around, in a sense, that's why I wanted to write about the scandal. I think putting things into words gives you and readers some relief. Yep. So first of all, there was a sense of, there was kind of a sense of relief, like, okay, I finally know what the problem is. Now, also there was a fact that I was getting a ton of Dilaudid, which is an opium derivative, which is basically I was having an opium dream in the midst of all this pain. So she told me, okay, you know, you're going to die from this. basically. And she left the room. And I remember looking out the, you know, it's like little plastic curtains in the ER. And I remember looking, everything kind of stopped and slowed down. But finally I knew what the heck was going on. And I looked out through this curtain and I remember seeing all these kind of people scurrying around. And, you know, it hit me like a ton of bricks. Like, what's the big deal? Like, everybody's got an end point. You guys are all going to have your end point. You know, mm-hmm. mine has come now. And I remember thinking, like, I didn't mourn the years I wouldn't have. I remember thinking, okay, this is the end of my story. This is how it ends. It was an interesting moment.
Well, and it's kind of such a Zen moment, right? I wondered when I read that, did you bring this sort of embrace of death, of the unknown, to Zen practice, or did you get it from there, or some kind of combination of both?
Maybe some kind of combination. I mean, my experience around death, with my teacher dying and those four deaths I talked about earlier, as well as just me facing it in that moment, you know, death is big. It's like bigger than our religions. It's bigger than my practice. I mean, I have to admit that. I think that in certain moments when you're really struggling and really suffering, you better believe if you have a strong practice, you're better off. I think it would be an inflation of my sense of my practice to say that I was able to handle that moment because I was such a good monk. I think it was probably the dilated. Yeah.
Well, okay, and let me not brush past this cool thing you just said, which is that the editors of Tricycle Magazine went to that moment particularly and went, come on. And right. how did you navigate that? I mean, because it ended up in the piece, right?
Yeah. Well, I changed it slightly because what happened was when this nurse gave me the news, she was kind of smiling and then she skipped out of the room. And I put that in the essay and they just didn't buy it. So I had to actually fictionalize that moment and say she responded more gravely to my situation.
Oh, because that's a really interesting scene, too, because you don't, I mean, as I just read it, I've read it a couple of times, and I don't know whether that was an opium dream, like a person who actually walked into the room and spoke to you, or somebody you made up because you were high.
Oh, I shouldn't have said anything. No, that was exactly what happened. And it was interesting. That's exactly what happened.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And, you know, the funny thing was I talked to the doctor about it later on. He didn't know who she was.
So really what they asked you to do then was just to amend it slightly to make it more believable?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the publication of this second book. And you had material that you knew was going to be explosive, really, within your immediate community and really sort of have all these wider ripples, right? Was it difficult to get this second book published?
What you described would make it easy to publish on some sense.
Really?
I think controversy is helps publication, and that was definitely not my aim. So what do you mean exactly? What do you mean by difficult to get to publish?
What was the response on behalf of the publisher when you said, this is what I'm writing about?
You know, I was pretty, you know, I've written two books with Shambhala, and I've got a great editor there, Dave O'Neill, and his attitude is pretty much just send me the next essay when you're done with it. So for the second book, I think I gave him maybe half of the essays, and it seemed like they were beginning to coalesce around the ideas that are in the subtitle of the book, which is death, failure, and bad sex.
Right.
So I gave them about half the book, and then I cranked out a few more essays, and then I kind of decided to write about the scandal. And I think Dave had even said at one point, kind of hinted around at how it was going to be, it would be, I don't want to misquote him, but something to the effect of, you should hit this material. Okay. as a writer. It's going to be, it's like an elephant in the room.
Sure.
I mean, every once in a while, people will respond to me on Facebook or tweet or something and say, you know, your teacher is this sexual predator and you're living in denial of it.
Right.
I think more than not, people within Zen Buddhist circles want this sort of thing talked about. Mm-hmm. Unless you're directly related to it, then it gets very touchy.
Yeah.
But people generally want it talked about. These scandals happen over and over and over, and you never hear about, like, from the inside. What you get from a community is a kind of a broad statement about a page long that's been worked over to death by the community's lawyers, mm-hmm. wherein they offer some kind of very stock statement and apology, but you never hear about what the hell it's like on the inside. And I think people are craving that. I know that's something that I really would have appreciated when I was going through the scandal, you know?
What?
Just having somebody speak about what it's really like.
Yeah.
You know, that craziness that you talked about, that tension and that.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, you're on the one hand, I understand where people are coming from when they're enraged about this topic. But somehow the online lynch mob mentality, I don't know how to put it. It's maybe in this cultural moment with our neophytes' experience with media, social media, technology, maybe it's inevitable, but being on the receiving end of it, you know, getting these phone calls and getting these emails where people are just looking for a target to fling their bile at, it really made me think twice about how I respond to things like this. I mean, right at the time, I'm going off on a tangent here, but just real quickly, right at the time of the scandal, our scandal, General Petraeus, his affair with that woman was exposed. Yeah, like literally right side by side, those two things were happening.
Oh.
And I remember seeing this picture on like CNN of, I forget what the woman's name was that he had an affair with, the reporter.
Me too.
Yeah, but somehow the cameras were snapping photos of her through her kitchen window. And I remember looking at her,
oh,
and I remember
God.
Thinking, pre-scandal, I would have been so quick to jump to a judgment about either one of them, you know?
Yeah.
It's one judgment or another. After or during the scandal, I thought, I know what you're going through.
Yeah.
I mean, I know, you know, I am no one to judge.
Yeah. Yeah. So do you feel like you grew as a writer because you tackled that material?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe matured as a writer.
Do you feel like you grew as a monk because you had to go through that?
Yeah, I would say so. Maybe grew right out of my robes, in fact.
Well, so let's talk about that a little bit. Do you have a sense of what you might be moving towards, both within Zen practice and writing?
I wish I did. A monastery is a really, it's not necessarily artificial environment, but it's a very purposeful, intentional environment. And when you leave it, you can't practice the same way when you re-enter the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really, I feel like a newborn in a lot of ways, being in the world again. And that's the path as a Zen monk, is you never stay at the monastery.
Right.
There's something called the ox herding pictures, and it's kind of a classical tale about a monk who glimpses this ox in the mountains, and the ox is a metaphor for enlightenment, and he follows the tracks, and eventually he's riding the ox, and sooner or later he's got to return from that mountain and that ox hunt into the, he called it, back in the marketplace.
Right.
So
he's riding he rides the ox eventually, right? And then he has to get back down and not ride the ox anymore.
What they don't tell you is there's a 10th panel on those 9 ox herding pictures. And the 10th panel is somewhere in there. He falls off the ox and gets trampled by the ox and returns to the marketplace with no job skills. That's basically what happened to me.
And what about your writing process? How has that changed now that you no longer are living in this community?
Well, for one thing, it's all I've got right now in some sense, other than my own private practice and some friends and family and my travels. So, you know, I don't have that crutch anymore as a monk where I could say I have this unique experience. Here it is.
Right.
You know, now my writing has to stand on its own without any of that help from my career and calling as a monk. So it's a big challenge, and I feel excited by it.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing what you do next. Well, it's been amazing talking to you again. I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, I feel like we're old friends.
I do too. If you ever come anywhere near Vermont, you have to let me know. I'll buy you a belt.
Oh, awesome. Awesome.
Maybe.
Good.
I hope our paths cross again.
I hope so too. Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for this. I loved it.
This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. And that was Kim McQueen interviewing Shozan Jack Haubner. He tweets at Shozan J. Haubner. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by Kim's and my guest, Shozan Jack Haubner. Sit in a quiet, comfortable way for 10 to 15 minutes. Put your attention on your soft, flowing breath. Do nothing but breathe. It's easy as long as you don't think too much. Breathing is a pleasurable sensation. Peace and focus manifest in the body and mind. If you can't loosen and open up, you can't write jack squat. Words surface of their own accord from a deep and bottomless well. And don't glance at your clock. Set a timer. When the timer goes off, take your pen and your writing notebook, or if you must, your laptop, and write what's coming up from the silence. Don't think about it, just like you didn't think about your breathing. Like breath, the words will come whether you think about them or not. Write until your hand aches without reading a word of it, until you've taken a break, gotten your coffee, checked your email if you must, and are ready to listen to yourself on the page as uncritically as a mother listens to her child learning to speak. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.